We will call the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement to order. Welcome to everyone. This is the second day in our two-day meetings here in October. For those of you who haven't been here before, we had two days of meetings back in September. And again, yesterday and today, going over a number of important issues for the Commission. And we will be meeting again on November 9th and 10th. And our goal today is to cover the last three items that were on the agenda. So for those of you that have that agenda, it's items 6, 7, and 8. And then as I mentioned to the Commission yesterday, we want to take some time at the end, to decide our agenda, the topics we want to cover, and map out a plan for the November 9th and 10th meeting. And so, members, be thinking about what's on your list of things that we ought to be considering for that November meeting. And again, I say that I would hope that we would spend maybe half of that meeting, or close to half anyway, having a serious discussion about what are the specific ideas that we want to put on our agenda for change or reform or whatever coming up in the next legislative session starting in January. So with that, any questions from Commission about today, what we're going to do today? If not, we have moving to our next agenda item, which is number six. And Ms. Ferkel, would you identify yourself, and you may proceed.
Thank you. I'm Cecile Ferkel. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I am responsible for the Financial Audit Division's work and reports that we issue. One of the big things that we do in the Financial Audit Division is audit the state of Minnesota's financial statements. It's a document that is quite big. You've perhaps seen it, and if you haven't, you know, let me know, and I'll make sure that you do get that available to you as a resource. We also audit within the scope of that audit and also individually the retirement system's financial statements for TRA, PERA, and MSRS. We audit those as well, and we also have audited SBI's financial statements. So we're quite involved in financial accounting and financial reporting for retirement systems and their assets and their liabilities. I've been asked to come here today and explain to you the changes that the Government Accounting Standards Board is considering in the way that governments and pension funds, public pension funds, report their financial activity. Those standards are being proposed by the GASB, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. One of the things that you have available to you is kind of a little fact sheet about the GASB, about who they are and why they exist. They are a independent, private sector, not-for-profit organization that's been set up in order to provide these kinds of generally accepted accounting principles for government, and the pension funds are included in that scope. I apologize, I wasn't able to get my slideshow showing for you today, so what I'm going to do is just go through the slides. You have a copy of those in front of you. I'll try to keep you on the same page. If you get lost, be sure to let me know that I need to redirect you to what slide we're on. So on the agenda today, I've talked about the GASB a little bit. If you have any questions about that, let me know later. Also, we're going to talk about what the current standards are, according to the GASB, for accounting for pensions and pension-related costs, both by the pension plans and by the governments, and also compare those then to what the proposed changes are. And then I'm going to just briefly talk about some of the issues that have been raised. If we go to slide four on the second page, GASB is looking at revisions to these pension standards because of some changes that are happening throughout the economy and the accounting community. The original standards were established back in about 1994, and they feel that the standards need some improvements in terms of consistency and transparency, and also comparability to allow pension plans to be compared to each other, and also governments' liability related to pension plans to be able to be comparable to other governments. They also want to make sure that the information provided through the financial reports is really providing the information needed by policymakers and other users of the reports, including taxpayers, the governments themselves, and also their creditors, the bonding agencies and the bonding community. These changes that they're proposing are similar to changes that you may be aware of from several years ago related to post post-employment options, other post-employment benefits. Those are where governments have promised health insurance or have promised other kinds of benefits to employees that are separate from pensions. So those changes incorporated into government's financial statements, the liability that those governments had accrued relating to benefits they had promised, other than pensions, benefits that they had promised to their employees after retirement. So now they're taking those ideas and those concepts and bringing them into the pension world and making changes that will primarily, I think the biggest change is bring that liability into the government's financial statements. What is the liability related to the pensions that have been promised to employees? Moving to the next slide, the two current standards are Statement 25, which relates to how the pension plans or the pension funds themselves prepare their financial information, and then also Statement number 27 that talks about how the governments that sponsor those plans then report that information. On the next slide, it shows the timeline of this project. It is something they've been working on for quite a while. They do have an extended due process to make sure that they provide all constituents that have an interest in pension funds, whether it's the pensioners, the unions, the pension plans, the governments, the auditors, the actuaries. Everybody gets a chance to say what they think of these plans. And frankly, everybody's been really vocal about what they think about these plans. There have been a lot of comments about them. So they started it back in 2008. They did an invitation to comment where they set out some broad parameters and said to the community, what do you think of this? Then they did a preliminary views. They used the information they had received and came up with what they thought, what direction they thought they were going to be going. Did that in 2010. And most recently, now we've had these two exposure drafts in June of 2011. The comment deadline was September 30th. I think as we speak, they're having some public hearings and in Chicago related to this. So it is an ongoing thing. No final statements have been developed yet. If it's approved as is, their timeline is that these new standards would be effective for financial statements beginning in 2014. For the big plans that we're talking about, they do have a later implementation date for some of the smaller plans I think it's a one-year delay, but for the ones that I think we're interested in here, the big plans for the state, it would be 2014, fiscal year 2014. So on page 3, the first slide at the top of the page there talks about what were the principles that they were looking at as they considered how governments and pension funds should account for their pensions. And the first thing they said is, well, if an item meets the definition of a liability, it should be recognized in the financial statements rather than just disclosed in the notes. And to date, the disclosure about a government's fundedness and a pension plan's fundedness has been either disclosed in the notes or disclosed in other information following the notes and financial statements. That liability has not yet been recorded in the financial statements. But they're saying if it meets the definition of a liability, shouldn't it really be reflected as a liability in the financial statements? So their definition of a liability is that if you have a present obligation, an obligation today, to sacrifice resources that you really don't have much discretion to avoid, then it's a liability. And so they're looking at pensions and they're saying, well, today we have an obligation to pay people that already have worked for us and already have contributed to the pension plan and already have been promised a pension in the future. We have an obligation today for those pensions. And so the GASB is concluding then that's a liability, and that's a liability that should be reflected in the financial statements of the government. Moving on to the next slide, they're saying that pension obligations are part of an employee's compensation. What they're saying there is every day when I come to work, I'm earning a little more of my pension by coming to work and working my 8 hours. I worked for the state for 30-plus years, and in that time I have done the work that I needed in order to earn the pension that has been promised to me. So they're saying that it's connected to the work that employees provide. They've also concluded that the government has an obligation now to provide those benefits at some time in the future, that through my 30-plus years of work experience, I've earned a right to that future pension, and so it is an obligation today. And then the final underlying principle, again, was that they should recognize pension costs in the period in which the services are provided. So what they're saying is, as I work another year, I have increased the pension expense that the state will have for me, and that expense related to my work effort this year should be recognized as an expense of this year's financial activity. Also, I'm willing to take questions at any point if you need clarification on these points. Going on to some more of their, what they call underlying principles, and this one I think has raised a lot of question too. Whose liability is it? And they've reached the conclusion that the pension plan is primarily responsible for paying the pension benefit to the extent that they have assets available to pay it. So those assets that they have, they are committed to paying the pension plan. But the conclusion of the GASB is that to the extent that the assets are not adequate to pay the pensions that have been promised, that's a responsibility of the sponsoring government, not of the plan. So it shifts back to the employer then, to the employing government, that's their liability. And this, again, you know, many of these things that I've just laid out for you are many of the things that are discussed within the comments that people are making in relationship to these proposals. So there certainly is not full agreement on many of these underlying principles at this point. Turning to the next page, on page 4, the top slide, talks about how costs have been allocated historically, maybe for many pension funds. And it's what they've allowed, what the principles, accounting principles have allowed, is pretty much a connection between how you fund your plan and the expense that gets recorded. And I'm going to go into a little more detail on this now, but one of the things that GASB has clearly stated here is that they're not trying to drive funding decisions. They're not creating any kind of funding requirements or setting up any kind of funding structure. They're just saying, if we're all going to prepare financial reports that we can compare to each other and make sense of using the same criteria and using the same set of accounting principles, this is the way the accounting is going to look. It does nothing to drive the funding decisions or the funding structure. So they're clearly stating this is accounting only. This is financial reporting. And for the plans and for the governments, it is not intended to be policy, funding policy, or influence funding policy.
Ms. Ferkel, we have a couple of questions at this point. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Ferkel, on slide 7, I think you might have just kind of answered it for accounting principles, but the underlying principle is that it should be not just disclosed in the financial statements, but if it's a liability, it should be recognized throughout. If it's been in the notes right along, then changing that it's part, the liability is part of the whole, then that wouldn't really make any change. It would just be for transparency purposes, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, what they're saying is that the financial statements themselves, which the notes are a part of it, but they're saying the statements themselves should reflect the liabilities of the government and that this is a liability. What's been in the notes, and actually this has been kind of a evolution over the last 4 or 5 years, it didn't used to even be in the notes, the fundedness and the history of the fundedness. And also the way that liability would have been calculated and disclosed in the notes. Now they're putting more parameters around that. We're going to get into that discussion in terms of defining or quantifying what that liability in the notes needs to be. Those things are changing too. But back maybe 4 years ago, it wouldn't have even been in the notes. It would have been in what we call required supplemental information, where the unfundedness would be disclosed. A few years ago, GASB said, that really doesn't elevate that unfundedness significantly, so we think Whitney needs a note disclosure. And now they're saying, well, that still doesn't really elevate the, really reflect the liabilities of the government appropriately. Would it be appropriate for government to shift other things only into its notes and not put them in the financial statements? Financial statements are meant to be full accounting of the assets and liabilities, and so they felt that this now needs to come into the actual financial statements themselves. So yes, more transparent and more accountable and more clearly able to see what the effect of the bottom line is on the government.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Ferkel, will they, do they anticipate a change in the outcome then?
Ms. Ferkel?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Do they anticipate that by including all that in the financial, then that maybe there won't be additional benefits, or maybe there won't, or that just, is it just that there will be greater understanding of the liabilities and the assets?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I have seen nothing that says that they are doing this in order to force or embarrass or coerce governments into funding their pensions. They are really just focused on having that number determined in a way that's more consistent across governments, and then having it disclosed as a liability of the government more transparently, so that it can be perhaps talked about more consistently, apples to apples, rather than all the variables that are in that number now.
Thank you.
Related to that question, I would assume that there's a distinct possibility that these new standards would result in unfunded liabilities increasing. Can you make a comment as to whether that is a possible outcome or likely outcome?
Mr. Chair, in theory, the fundedness or unfundedness of a plan would depend on the plan and the contributions and the benefits that are paid. In reality today, many, many pension plans are underfunded and have liabilities that are, according to the GASB, not being recognized by the governments in their financial statements. And actually in the standards, it does say that these standards are directed towards recognition of the liability and are not at this point addressing, well, what about if there's extra money in the pension plans? What if they're 120% funded? Do those assets come back to the government on the balance sheet? And they're saying, we're not answering that question now. We're really directing this toward ensuring that governments disclose in the financial statements the liability related to pensions.
Is it likely or possible that Minnesota's funds will show greater unfunded liability?
Mr. Chair, based on past fundedness, I'm not sure what the current situation is for fiscal year 2011, but I would expect that there is a liability that the state of Minnesota and other employers would show related to the pension plans, the TRAP area and MSRS. I would expect that, but I have not seen the numbers myself. That would be something that plans perhaps could provide.
Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Ferkel, you mentioned that there's disagreement about the underlying principles. Could you just share with us some of the most significant concerns that folks have expressed?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think it might be better to talk about that after I've talked about what some of the changes are, if you don't mind, because, and I do have at the end of it some of the common things that people are objecting to, and I'm just concerned that without already having gone through what some of the changes are, you might not fully understand the disagreements.
Thank you.
Okay, you may proceed.
Okay, returning then to, I lost track because I flipped the page here.
On page four?
I think we're going to page four, the middle slide. The major proposed changes then, and we've already talked about this, government employers, not the pension plans, but the government employers would record the unfunded portion of the total pension liability as a liability on their balance sheets in their financial statements. Moving on to the next slide, expanding on that, if the current and expected future plan assets related to current members, so current employees, current retirees, are insufficient to cover the total pension liability, the long-term rate of return cannot be used. So to discount that, and I'm going to have a slide that kind of explains that a couple slides on. But what they're saying is right now many pension plans will say, well, we expect to earn some amount as investment earnings, 8.5%. So when we figure out what the future benefits are, we're going to incorporate an investment return there. And then when we bring that back to the present value to say, well, what is the cost of that future obligation in today's dollars, many pension plans use a discount rate that is parallel then to their investment rate. And I believe for the state of Minnesota that's an 8.5%. Discount that they use to bring those that obligation, that benefit cost back to the present dollars. They're saying, well, you can, what GASB is saying is, well, you can do that as long as you have enough assets to cover that obligation. But at the point that your assets don't cover the obligation, you can't continue to invest assets you don't have. So you can't use that investment rate of return as your discount rate. And they are now proposing that discount rate for the part you don't have the money to cover, that discount rate be linked to the 10-year municipal bond rate, which many of you may know is significantly less than 8.5%. And when you reduce the discount rate, it increases the liability. So that is one really significant way that this change would impact the liability. As it's calculated today, maybe it's $1 billion. If you don't use the 8.5% to discount the whole benefit, you only use it to discount a part of it, and then the unfunded part, you use this municipal bond rate, which is significantly lower, you're going to increase that liability from, I don't know, $1 billion to $1.3 billion or something like that. So that is one of the points that governments it's one of the points of discussion. On the next slide, I'm sorry, this gets pretty small to read. The next slide talks about what's going to change. It's comparing the current GASB requirements to the new proposed exposure draft requirements for the unfunded liability. So right now, in the first slide, the current GASB, right now, governments, employers do not report on their financial statements a liability related to their unfunded pensions. It's not there. So right now, what's reported as a liability for pension obligation is zero. What's being proposed is that governments will report on their financial statements the portion of the unfunded liability that relates to the benefit obligation that's been incurred by that date. So if we look at the next slide, the little diagram one. The numbers there refer to the age of an employee. So an employee who's 25 years old, 40 years old, 62 years old, I think they're assuming retirement at that point, and that person is going to live to be 80 years old. So they have a three-step process to figure out what this liability is. And the first step is, what is the future benefit that we have promised to this employee because they're working for us? And they're saying, well, if the employee who's 25 years old works until they're 62 years old and contributes at the rate that they're required to contribute, and the state contributes at the rate that they're required to contribute over those years, and we take that money and we invest it and we earn the 8.5% that we expect to earn over a span of time, that'll give us some amount of money at age 62. And the benefits we've provided them are based on their high five salary and their years of service, so we can calculate that, and we know what those benefits are and what expected increases there might be in those benefits. So the first step is to say, for that employee, what is that projected benefit amount? If we move to the next slide, then the next step is to bring that future benefit back to what's the cost today, what's the present value of that benefit today for that employee. And if we think, well, okay, that employee started with the state of Minnesota or with the school district when they were 25 years old, but today they're 40 years old. So they've put in so many years of service, 15 years of service, 25 years of service. I'm sorry. When I'm talking, I can't quite add that up that fast. But today they're 40. So they've put in a certain number of years of service, and they have years of service to do in the future. So today the obligation is based on the work they've already provided. It's not what they're saying, what part of that future obligation is related to the years they haven't worked for us and what part of it is related to the years they have worked for us. So on the next page, then, the final step, step three, remember, step one is what's the benefit? Step two is what's the value of that benefit in today's dollars, discounting it back. Step three is saying let's allocate that then across the years of service. And let's total up how much of that liability that we've accrued for that employee through the financial reporting date. So how much work have they provided and how much of that benefit have they earned today when they're 40 years old and they've worked for us since they were 25. So that looks simple, right? You know, these things get really complicated really fast because we've been talking about one employee and now we're going to be talking about 30,000 employees. And that's where the actuaries come in. They say, well, the population of state employees, they have people who are 25 and worked a year. They've got people who are 62 and, you know, have worked 40 years. They've got people who didn't retire. They're 68 years old. Not everybody lives to be 80. There's men and there are women and they have different mortalities. And some people are going to work for 10 years and they're going to leave and they're going to take their money with them. They're not going to stay retirement. So the actuaries take all these variables and they use certain criteria and certain standards that they have to figure out what they project that total benefit is going to be based on the population and the demographics of today's population in the plan, whether it's teachers or firefighters or state employees. And they figure out what that total future benefit is, and then they need to discount that back and they need to allocate it based on what the years of service and the expectations within the population are again. So it really gets very complicated when you start applying this principle to a broad group. The next slide then says, well, that's the total pension obligation. What would be the employer's net pension obligation? And that's the question of, okay, you've figured out what the future benefit is. You've discounted it back to present-day dollars. You've allocated it across the employee's useful life. But how well do our assets cover that liability? And that's where they're saying you look at assets as of the date of the financial statement. So as of June 30th, what is the market value of the assets? And can that market value of the assets cover the obligation that the state has today for its employees today for future benefits that it's promised based on work employees have performed through the financial statement date? If the assets are not sufficient to cover that liability, that's the amount that would then show up on the financial statements as a liability to the state or to the government for its pension costs. That is not exactly what an unfunded ratio is. You know, so there's a difference between that. I mean, this is saying how much of that is related to what we're obligated for at the point that you do the financial statements, which is different from saying, can the plan fund all of its, you know, the plan's going to figure that next year new people are going to come in and start working for the state and that, you know, other factors will influence it. This is saying, as of this point in time, what's the amount that the state's or the other employer is on the hook for pensions that have already been obligated compared to the assets that are really available today at a market value valuation.
Mr.
Senator Pugnoli.
Is it as simple as saying if the fund ended tomorrow?
Ms. Ferkel?
Mr. Chair and Senator, it is more looking at it that way.
You close the fund, I think.
It is more looking at it that way. What have we obligated today?
If we
and how much money do we have today? A little different, though, because in figuring that out, they do anticipate based on, you know, the actuary anticipates based on their understanding of how many of the employees today are going to continue working and that there will be future money coming in. I think it really is more today because you look at today's market value of today's assets. How well do those match up against the obligation? So it is very much like that. Today, what is the liability?
You may proceed.
Okay, on the next slide, again, it's got that little graphic. It's talking about the employer's pension expense. So now we're shifting from what the liability is on the balance sheet. We're looking at the income statement. what is the expense now for any given fiscal year? Right now, what that expense is if the government is required to contribute 4% or 6% to the pension fund for its employees, if the government contributes that required amount, then that is their pension expense, and that's it. It's the required contribution amount. If the government doesn't contribute the whole amount, then there's a note disclosure about the deficiency that the government has. The state of Minnesota contributes its required amount. There hasn't been a disparity there that I'm aware of. In the new exposure draft, that expense can change from the required contribution amount. And what it does is you know, if you think back to, well, at the beginning of the year, at the end of the previous year, you figured out what your liability was. Another year has gone by, so now more employees have joined and some employees have left, and the market either has or hasn't performed at the 8.5% for that year, and the assets. So the assets may be better or worse able to meet the obligation of the pension obligation as it's figured out now at the end of the following year. If there's been a change in, like, maybe the benefits have changed to either provide more benefits or less benefits to employees, or maybe the assets increased well beyond the 8.5% or fell far short of the 8.5%, those kinds of changes are reflected in the current year's pension expense. To the extent that the pension didn't perform in the way that you had anticipated that it would perform, you recognize that as an expense in the current year. You figure out the pension liability the same way as you did before, but you recognize the total change in that liability from one year to the next as an expense in that year. So if there was to be a change in the pension benefits, so let's just use that example, and the pension benefits, let's say, were increased, and so those benefits are going to increase throughout the life of the pension, and if we use me again as an example, I'm going to get the benefit of that based on the 30 years of service that I've provided, but you don't go and reallocate that increased pension cost back through all those 30 years. You say, well, a year ago that liability was X, and now because we changed the benefits, that liability for those 30 years of service is now X plus the additional benefits, and we have to show all of that cost of the additional benefits for all of those 30 years in that year then. You recognize the total impact of that. Also, again, if assets are able to be invested in a way that they produce a really significantly greater investment income, now that liability has decreased, and you compare this year's liability to last year's liability, and you can then reflect that total change also in that year. Moving on to page 7, the middle slide there. The amortization of the unfunded liability. What governments have been able to do now is choose the period over which they're going to amortize the amount of their pension that's not been funded, and up to a maximum of 30 years. And you know, so 30 years is a number that I believe is pretty commonly used because that's as far as you can go. The exposure draft is really going to change that. As I was just explaining, changes that affect the benefits or the contribution rates, those kinds of things, you're going to reflect those right away. You're not even going to be allowed to amortize those things. Gains and losses on the active liability, you're going to be able to amortize those things only over the working life of the employee, the remaining working life of the employee. So if there's been a change for me, let's say, I can amortize some of that change over what I have left to work. I'm going to have to recognize what I've already worked, but I can amortize some of that change over the 4 or 5 or 6 years that I have remaining. Up to a maximum, the maximum amount would be the, you know, as you look at the population of the plan, the people in the plan overall, on the average, how many years do you have to amortize that over if you look at what their average working life is. Right now, I think state government employees are probably tipping more towards the 20, 25 years of work experience or more, and fewer younger people. So that's going to mean that the amount of years that you can amortize those costs over is going to be significantly less than 30 years. It perhaps would be 20 years or 15 years, but that, again, is a number that the actuaries would be analyzing and determining. Again, because you can amortize that cost over a shorter period, you're going to have to recognize more of it in any given year, and that's going to, again, increase the pension cost. On the next slide, we're talking about the discount rate, and I already talked about this a little bit. I do apologize that this stuff gets also nitty-gritty and detailed, and a lot of it is actuarial, which I'm not an actuary. I'm an accountant, so I'm sure an actuary, you know, would be able to provide you a better and in some cases even perhaps more accurate description than what I'm attempting to do here. But this is the way that I understand these things. The next slide on the bottom of page 7 is the discount rate. And again, this is how do you bring that future pension benefit that you've calculated, how do you bring that back to today's dollars? And historically, governments and pension plans have been allowed to use a long-term rate of return, which is tied to your investment earnings. I believe that that in Minnesota has generally been about 8.5%. And that was how you were able to say, well, that's the cost of that future benefit payment today is this amount of money, assuming that 8.5%. What GASB is saying, though, is, but if you don't have assets to invest, you're going to have to fill that gap somehow, and we're going to have to assign some kind of a discount rate to that. And so they kind of went to the default position that if you don't have the money, you're going to have to borrow for it. Many, many, many options are available other than that, but they wanted to have one discount rate that would be used in that situation for the part of the future benefit that you don't have the money to pay for. They wanted all government employers to use a set rate, and so they settled on this long-term municipal bond rate, high-quality municipal bond rate, which probably is closer to 3 or 4 or 5% than 8.5%. And that's a pretty big difference and really would result in a pretty significant increase in a liability to the government. So the implications of that, if a plan is not fully funded, the municipal bond rate will increase the unfunded liability. You know, I guess that's assuming, of course, that their expected long-term rate of return exceeds what their long-term bond rate is, which probably is across the board true. So that, again, is another area that people have really had a lot of comments on. On the top of the next page gets into which actuarial cost method can be used. Again, as you look at the demographics and the population of employees and retirees, plans have been able to choose from a variety. I think that there are 6 allowable actuarial cost methods that they can use in their determinations of these future benefits. The exposure draft now has said, for financial reporting purposes, we want everybody to use the same actuarial cost method. And they've stated that they want the financial liability to be determined using the entry age normal actuarial cost method. You'd really need an actuary up here to explain to you what that is and how it's different from all the other ones. But the GASB has said, this is one of the variables as you're looking across governments and saying, well, what's Minnesota's liability? What's Wisconsin's liability? What's Iowa's liability? This is one of the variables that governments have the option to choose that creates difficulty in comparing Minnesota's pension liability to other states or other governments. So this is one of the ways that they are trying to create some consistency and comparability.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for our own staff, because the subject is right here, the entry age normal actuarial cost method, what is the method that we currently use?
Mr. Chair, yes, members, since 1965, Minnesota statute has specified the entry age normal cost method.
Oh, good.
So we've used it for the past 45 years.
That's a significant issue, and good to know that we were doing this kind of methodology prior to this happening, and so that's really good to hear.
The sole exception would be perhaps for volunteer fire pension plans that pay a lump sum benefit where they're not required to have an actuary, so there's a rough-hewn version of an actuarial method, but it would not purely be entry age normal.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Would then, because of this, and maybe this is either for Ms. Ferkel or for you, Mr. Martin, would this change in GASB then require them to all use that then?
Ms. Martin? I would defer to Ms. Ferkel.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Ferkel?
Mr. Chair and Representative, for financial reporting purposes, it would require them to use the entry age normal method.
Thank you.
On the next slide, talking here about asset smoothing, that is a method used, and the state of Minnesota uses this, to try to take some of the volatility out of investment returns. And asset smoothing allows you to determine separately from, in the financial statements, you value your assets at market value. What is the value of that asset at June 30th in the market? And that's the amount of the assets on the financial statements. When you're figuring out currently your unfundedness, you determine a actuarial value of the assets, which is not the market value. It smooths out market effects for the assets over a period of time. I think that the state of Minnesota smooths over 8 years. So any losses of this year are going to be allocated over the next 8 years, and last year's gains will be allocated over a future period, too. And it's meant to take out of the determination of whether how well-funded the fund is, to take out some of that investment volatility because, you know, the plans do invest over a long period of time. These benefits are you know, not payable for many people for another 20, 30 years, and so it allows for a broader view. But what the GASB is saying, well, that's fine for pension plans, for their investment planning, for their funding decisions, but for financial reporting, that's not going to be adequate. We're going to only allow the difference between the assumed and actual investment return to be spread over 5 years. The assets will still be reported on the financial statements at market value, but this is then, I think, in determining what the future obligation is and how that's allocated among the years of service. It's part of that determination of what the liability would be. They do allow a small amount of smoothing of one aspect of the investment return. On the next slide, consistency between the criteria used for funding and accounting. Currently, right now, GASB pretty much says, you know, whatever your way of determining the fundedness of the plan is fine for financial reporting. That's what you can put in your notes. And they pretty much leave it up to the governments to decide, as long as it meets actuarial standards, you know, decide what's going to be disclosed. Now they're saying there can and probably will be a difference between what is determined as the liability for financial reporting purposes and how the plans or the policymakers or the funding, you know, funding decisions are made that can be using different criteria. GASB is not trying to control that aspect of pension plan operation. What they're trying to do is say that financial reporting should be more clear and more precise, and so these are the rules for financial reporting. So that will no doubt result in double sets of numbers. Here are the numbers for financial reporting. Here are the numbers for analysis and funding decisions. And, of course, then it will also require policymakers to really understand the difference between the two and be able to speak to those differences if financial statements are a source of information for taxpayers, for constituents of the pension plans, and they see one unfundedness or ratio or one amount of unfunded liability, and then what policymakers are dealing with, and they're using some different set of numbers. It seems to me like that's a confusion that will result from this change in the GASB standards and something that boards and legislators and commissions and administrators in the plans will need to be able to deal with. The top slide on page 9, some of the common concerns. So there is concern about this discount rate, about the rate of return. Why can't we use the 8.5% for the whole thing? Why use the long-term bond rate? Why assume that selling bonds is the way that gap is going to be filled? Lots of discussion about the discount rate and lots of dissatisfaction with that choice and other options that people would like to see. Another common concern is the allocation of the net pension liability to the employers in a multiple employer plan. I haven't really made that distinction yet, but the state of Minnesota is the primary employer for a number of plans, like the state patrol and the correctional employees. Those are primarily state employees that belong to those plans. So that's called a single employer plan. But a plan like TRA, where all, you know, 400 or 500 school districts are all employers within that plan, this liability will need to be allocated proportionately out to all of those employers, and all of those employers will be required to show their share of that liability, whether it's a city or a county or a school district, their share of that liability that TRA will determine and allocate to them. So that really is a point of concern. Cities and school districts are saying, well, if the plan tells me that my obligation is to contribute, my employees contribute 4%, and we contribute 4%, or whatever the requirement is, as long as we're doing that, you're telling me my employees are covered by a pension plan, and they don't feel that it's appropriate to bring that liability back to their financial statements. Many respondents have said, boy, that's really going to inflate the liabilities of these local governments. GASB has pretty much said, but the local governments have that liability, so isn't it better to have it on the financial statements and put it out there so that taxpayers of that community can see that their school district has this pension liability that has not been funded yet through contributions or the expected investment earnings. So there is a dispute about that. There's a lot of confusion about that, too. The logistics of actually allocating it and also auditing those allocated amounts, that also is a concern of many of the pension plans, that this is a lot of additional work that they're going to have to do, and they're concerned about the time and effort to be able to provide that information to all of their local units of government and their school districts. Another common concern is the volatility of the pension expense and the net pension liability. Again, because it's linked to the market value of the assets, you're going to be seeing a lot more volatility. I mean, we're all familiar with how volatile the market has been over the last 10 years. I mean, it's up, it's down, and not little bits. You know, it's up and it's down. And those things are going to be more rolled into that pension liability. The liability may really vary from one year to the next rather than be more of a smooth or predictable kind of liability. Again, GASB saying, well, that's the reality of the market, is that that liability does change. So they hold to their position at this point that it should be the market value of the assets, and that the volatility of the liability, they don't think, is necessarily a legitimate reason to change what they're proposing. But there is a lot of concern about that. The time and cost to implement, I already kind of indicated that, but also it will require, you know, where actuaries maybe right now are figuring out one set of results from their studies, from their work, they're now going to have to figure out a financial statement fundedness and projections along with ones that provide the compliance with the funding policies. So there's going to be dual work there, too. Also, as auditors, as a number rolls into financial statements, auditors become more concerned about how fairly presented that number is. And so it will require more of an audit effort for everybody, you know, at whatever level of government to be able to validate that number and for the auditors to feel comfortable with giving an opinion on how fairly presented that number is. The next common concern that I've listed is the ability of the pension plans to provide that data at the employer's year end. You know, the state of Minnesota's year end is June 30th, but what if the school district's or the county's year end is December 31st? That's the point that they have to report the liability. So will the pension plans now have to recalculate, you know, for every year end of every one of their 400 school districts or thousands of local government units? That's a question that really hasn't been settled within the scope of the current standards, and that's a concern that many of the pension plans have. Another concern is that, you know, the financial reporting is already pretty complex. I held this up. It's what, a couple hundred pages long. It's full of a lot of detailed information. I'm sure as you've sat here today and listened to me try to explain what that pension obligation is and how it's calculated, you've thought, boy, that's a lot of complex calculations, a lot of actuarial determinations. A lot of people have commented that this is adding just further complexity to financial reporting that already is really complex and hard to understand. And is that really the point of financial reporting? Aren't you really trying to clearly and concisely explain financial position. So that's another thing that, that people have brought up. And then audit concerns, I already talked about that. So finally, I provided you, GASB has these full context of the exposure drafts available on their website. Also available on their website are all the over 200 letters that people have submitted to comment. And those are submitted by actuaries, governments, auditors, citizens, unions, all across the board. If you want to see what points of view people have, those are available on their website as well. One last thing that I didn't mention that I've seen in the last couple of years has been the one of the concerns that was brought up was, well, what is, if this liability gets on the states or other governments' financial statements, what's that going to do to our ability to sell our bonds? We're going to look like we're in a really bad financial position if we reflect that liability. And are we going to be able, is this going to impact our ability to sell our bonds or impact the rate that we can sell them at? Well, what I've been seeing happening in that environment is that the SEC is getting involved in the disclosures that states and other municipal governments are requiring to make related to their pensions in their official statements when they sell the bonds. And the SEC is moving more in line with what GASB is proposing here, and I'm not sure which way this is going, who's pushing who. But the SEC is saying, hey, wait a minute, you've reported your financial reports, and that's fine, but you have not fully disclosed your pension liability. And they've required significantly more disclosure about pension liabilities than what's currently included in the financial statements. What GASB is proposing here will really put into the financial statements more of what the SEC is currently requiring to be included in those official statements. Maybe about 6 months ago, well, they went after first, I shouldn't maybe say went after, the SEC investigated New Jersey, the state of New Jersey, and their bond offerings, and they didn't ultimately fine them, but they sanctioned them publicly, kind of publicly shamed them about how their official statements had in the past, and they went back like 6 years, had not fully disclosed their pension obligation. They had not then provided people who bought their bonds with a really clear picture of what the financial status of the state was, because this pension obligation was not disclosed. And the state of New Jersey went from about a page and a half of pension disclosures to about 12 pages of pension disclosures in order to satisfy what SEC was saying needed to be in those disclosures. SEC went very public with saying, let this be a lesson to all the rest of you. And the last couple of times that the state has issued bonds, they have increased and continued to increase their disclosures related to the state's bond liability well beyond what would be found in the current financial statements. So I think that the concern about the impact on the bond market, it probably has already happened. And by moving more towards a consistent way of valuing and quantifying this liability, probably would be a good thing for bond issuers to have, rather than be able to impact so many different variables in that calculation to either inflate or decrease the amount of your liability related pensions. Let's get everybody kind of on the same, following the same rules here.
Well, Ms. Ferkel, thank you for a very thorough overview here of these standards that are coming at us. Even though we're talking here about an implementation date of 2014, it's very important for this commission to be aware of what's coming and what the changes will be. To me, a pressing question at this point is, do we need to consider any policy changes in the short term in order to better prepare Minnesota to accommodate these changes in standards that are coming? Are there things that we ought to adjust or readjust or change to better prepare, better anticipate what it is we're going to have to do here?
Mr. Chair, I think right now the statutes require that all of the plans and the state of Minnesota prepare their financial statements in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. If these become generally accepted accounting principles, that will be the way that the state and the retirement systems prepare their financial statements. And there, I don't see that there's any change in the statutes in order to accommodate that, the change in the accounting principles. I think the question more becomes how much does the state or do any of the plans want to use that financial statement information as a way to assess how they fund their plans. You know, there certainly are differences now in the way that the statutes lay out the calculation of the unfunded liability and you know, the entry age normal, if you hadn't been using that, if you've been using something else, you might want to say, well, do we want to align with that? So that's one of the things that isn't a discrepancy between our funding calculations and our financial statement calculations. But there's no requirement that you do that. Those clearly are policy decisions, and the policy setting can decide what they're going to use in order to assess the adequacy of their pension plans. So, you know, I think that might be the only thing. To what extent do you want to align funding policy with financial reporting? But that is entirely at your discretion.
I guess I would pose the same question to our funds, whether or not they would advise us that we ought to anticipate these changes and make some changes in terms of policy or approach to these things. And kind of related to that is whether or not what is the interaction of these new standards going to be with the issue of assumed rate of return. We've had quite a bit of discussion in our meeting so far about this 8.5% and where that ought to be, what the level of assumed rate ought to be in our returns. What's the possible interaction here? Is it likely that these new standards will really force us to be more conservative or approach the assumed rate of return differently than we have?
Mr. Chair, I don't think so. I mean, they haven't said the assumed rate of return has to be within a certain percentage of something, or that it has to, you know, be compared to actual return, or it pretty much says whatever your assumed rate of return is acceptable. I think, though, that as the actuaries use those numbers, that their actuarial standards may require some assessment of whether or not the assumed rate of return is reasonably achievable. But that isn't something that's addressed in these standards. I that would be a question I would ask the actuaries.
But if we're at 8.5% and we go through a series of years where we're significantly below that, I guess my question is, what's the interaction going to be with the new standards coming from GASB, and is that going to work against us or not? So,
well, Mr. Chair, the standards require that you disclose the rate of return you're using.
Right.
So a reader of the financial statements could say, well, they're using 8.5%, and I think that's too high. And, you know, a person reading it could make that personal judgment. I really think that it's something that the actuaries make a decision about. And you know, if you were to choose a rate of return of 25%, in today's market and say, well, we think we can achieve 25% over 30 years, the actuaries might say that's not going to comply with our standards, you know, with the actuarial standards. That's really where that number is used, is in all the actuarial calculations. So I think the actuaries probably could better speak to that. The GASB standards don't. The GASB standards say that the actuaries have to follow their standards. And I think it's something in their standards that would call into question the reasonableness of the assumed rate of return.
Questions from the commission? Representative Kahn.
Well, there are a couple of...
Mr. Chairman and members, there are a couple of things that bother me about it. One is looking at this common concerns. The one that bothers me the most is the volatility of the pension expense and the net pension liability, and how, or either how we react to volatility. I remember at the time when the market really turned down, there was a blog or an instruction from my favorite economist, Robert Reich, who said, whatever you do, don't open your accounts and look at them. And if you do that, certainly don't act on them.
Yeah.
And that's in general, as things go down, the best thing to do is to just remain, you know, remain in place. But you know, it's one of the, it's not a law of physics, I guess it's a law of accounting that things are pretty cyclical. So that thing depends on specifically if we're looking at one point in time, that volatility might really push us into the wrong direction. The other issue, and you sort of answered it, but I'm not sure you completely answered it. When New Jersey did this with their things, what happened when they went out for bonds? You said it's already had its effect on the bond market. But did they have more trouble selling bonds? Did the rate they have to sell them at become higher? Was there a dramatic increase in the effect on the state as it did it? Those are my two questions.
Ms. Perkle?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I haven't seen information that it affected their bond rate. It more required them to provide much more extensive disclosures in order to, I think if they hadn't done that, it would have affected their rate in a negative way. So, I mean, they complied with what the SEC wanted, and I don't believe that by complying with it and providing more disclosure that made them look like a more of a credit risk to the people buying the bonds. I think it's become pretty common knowledge that there is a liability related to pensions, and that's why there is this push to say, well, if it's there, let's see how much it is. I think that back during the time when the SEC was looking at it, back more historically for New Jersey, when they were selling the bonds without the pensions being so front and center, it also was a time when pension liabilities weren't so front and center to anybody. It wasn't, I don't think, like New Jersey was trying to hide anything. I think that they were just, it wasn't as much of an issue as it is today, that this is a real liability of government that government needs to better disclose.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
No, I mean, if the disclosure shows that there's more liability, which seems to show that it shows that the state is in worse shape, or who's ever doing it is in worse shape, and it doesn't have any effect on the bond market, I'm not sure what all the problems are. I mean, not that the bond market is perfect, but it's the first outside opinion that we get of what our financial state is, mm-hmm. and what our ability to pay.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I can't resist having the two authors of the stadium bill here, that that if we funded the stadium by selling bonds to do it, that would be one, and you're also members of the Pension Commission, you could decide whether it's a good state investment to put state investment funds into doing it, but we'd also have the outside market tell us as to whether they think it's a good investment. Sorry, I know that's an aside, and I don't expect an answer.
We'll save that for another day. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Perkle. Excellent presentation on a difficult subject, and I really appreciate a great deal. But I look upon it also from the employee perspective. You know, over those 30 years, I would rather pay 0.25% more over those 30 years and have a steady pension later on than to have the volatility of both the employer and the employee contributions. I think our goal as a pension commission is to use this as data, valuable data, what we do as a policy. But I personally think that your concern, Representative Kahn, is well recognized, and I think it is something that we as legislators, especially on the Pension Commission, have a particular responsibility to do that. But I would rather know what I'm going into so that I can make a good policy decision. I would rather know earlier so that the lack of volatility comes with recognizing that liability and having enough time to have a small response to it over a longer period of time, because that's more fair. And the other thing is that I don't want one group of employees to retire and have a rich set of benefits, and then future employees get hit with this surprise unfunded liability and all of a sudden having to increase their contributions and take a reduction in their benefits. I mean, to me, I want to see all employees at the point at which they're either employed or retired have a fairness applied to them in what they contribute and in what they receive as a benefit. So I think the best way for that to happen for us is having these recognition and these knowing about them and knowing about them as early as possible. I think you're right, Representative Kahn. We as legislators have to really restrain ourselves too. But that's where I so appreciate the pension plan managers, the SBI directors, and all of those expertise that we give careful consideration to them before we take an action opening the envelope. But I think knowing about them, very, very important.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the GASB at a glance, and specifically paragraphs 5 and 6 relative to income and expenses of GASB. Excuse me. Do you have access to, I would be liking to see a financial statement showing me the sources of income for GASB and how it's spent. There's reference to, in paragraph 6, reference to financial community. I'd like to know who that is and so forth. How many staff, what their salaries are. Do you have access, and can you provide this commission with a financial statement showing the income and the expenses of GASB for the last year?
Ms. Ferkel?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would expect that I can get that information for you.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Ferkel, when can we expect that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, when I get back to the office, I'll see what they have available on their website. My expectation is that that information would be there, and I could email it to you by the end of the day if it's available. I certainly can get back to you and let you know if I've been able to locate it.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Ferkel, do you know offhand what right now what their income is and what their expenses are in a year? And do you know if Minnesota contributes funding?
Ms. Ferkel?
Mr. Chair and Representative, Minnesota does contribute to the funding. We make a contribution through the state to fund the organization, as all the states do. I don't know what their income is, no.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Ferkel, how much does Minnesota contribute on a yearly basis?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I don't know exactly. I think that it's around $5,000 or $8,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I look forward to seeing specific numbers on income, sources of income, a breakdown of the references made in paragraph 6 and 5 of your handout. Thank you.
Further questions or discussion? Part of the commission? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Ferkel, I was interested in the information on this document also, and I was looking throughout this whole thing, and I looked at the website on Ms. Kahn's magic machine, but I was hoping that there was a picture of Gatsby, because as you talked, I thought, I didn't know if GASB was a board kind of like us, a commission, or if it was 150 people or 1,000 people or whatever. And then I read this, and there's 7, and they're either from the East Coast or the West Coast, and nothing in between. And it says they're composed of members drawn from, but I don't know, were they elected or are they hired or they, and who does the hiring if that's the case, and the election, and how often are the board terms, And how do one of us get on that board? And mileage. It's just so intriguing, and I couldn't find it on the magic machine, that information. But it doesn't sound like a very, it doesn't, I read like a very diverse board. And where's the Midwest input?
Lots of good questions there.
Mr. Chair, I'll find answers to as many of those questions as I can.
Because that, Mr. Chair, I think, you know, having answers like that and to what Representative Smith asked makes us perhaps more confident or not confident of how far we should go with their suggestions. And one comment that Ms. Ferkel made when you were talking about the, I think it was the New Jersey situation, and you said, and GASB didn't find them. Do they have powers to find?
Mr. Chair, it wasn't GASB, it was the SEC.
Thank you. Thanks for that clarification. Because I was thinking, what kind of powers do they have then if they're just a seven-member nonprofit with no one from the Midwest?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogno.
Well, Representative Murphy, I think math and accounting are kind of the same whether you live in New York, Oregon, or Minneapolis.
Mr. Chair.
I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just very intrigued by this line of questioning. So, of course, you know, not quite as new on this board as some members, but perhaps there's a history here that maybe we need to inform everybody about. I'm not sure, but I guess my question to you, Ms. Ferkel, is these are recommendations, or are these standards that have to be adopted? And if they're just recommendations, how many of the other states are looking, are going to be adopting these, or just continuing on with their regular math?
Ms. Ferkel?
Mr. Chair and Senator, GASB has had throughout its history, probably back into the 80s sometime, various levels of dispute about how their policies or standards had to be followed. They are considered the standard-setting board for government accounting principles, and so if you're going to have an audit done in accordance with generally accepted government accounting principles, that's what the auditors are going to look to. How well have you complied with those standards? There have been one of the more recent disputes with GASB. There have been a couple of them. One of them was when the OPEB information, the other post-employment benefits, and those standards came out. The state of Texas really took exception to the OPEB caps even. And they passed a law that said that their local units of government and their state government didn't have to comply with GASB if they didn't want to. So at first they were going to say, you cannot comply, do not comply, do not show the liability related to your other post-employment benefits on your financial statements. They softened that up a little bit and said, you don't have to comply with GASB in the state of Texas if you don't want to. So our statutes say that the state of Minnesota and the pension plans will prepare financial statements in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. If GASB adopts these, they will become generally accepted accounting principles, and so our statutes in Minnesota will require the state to prepare its financial statements and the pension plans to comply with those standards. So that's where the requirement is. It's GASB setting the standard, but it's the statutes requiring the state of Minnesota governmental entities to follow those standards. Again, Texas said, we're not going to make people follow that part of those standards. So that could happen, you know, that the state could decide that they're going to take an exception to that. The other thing that's happened is that GASB has over the last few years, moved beyond financial accounting and financial reporting and gotten into an area called
how well they provide their service. It's service level accomplishment or something like that. And they've set up some standards, or they've proposed some standards for how governments can measure how well they're accomplishing their goals. And quite a few entities, including the Government Finance Officers Association, have said, wait a minute, you're really moving well beyond what the purpose of the GASB is, and we're not supporting you in these efforts. So there is not always full support of GASB and where it's going. I think that GASB's process is intended to provide a lot of input and a lot of consideration. They're not just making the rules based on their limited, you know, the six people that are members. It's not based on just their limited knowledge and their limited goals. They do seek input from everybody and anybody. As I said, right now they're having public hearings about these standards right now. So they're weighing various different things. They're weighing whether or not this really is a liability against all the other factors. They're weighing how can we use this information if the state of Wisconsin figures their liability using all these different parameters and the state of Minnesota uses entirely different ways of figuring it out? Are those numbers even comparable anymore? And they're weighing a lot of different factors in trying to achieve a standard that meets what they believe are the needs of the users of the financial statements. Thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Ferkel. I think my question has to do also with, we had a discussion yesterday about defined benefit, defined contribution. And so how do these things interplay with those two? So it might be the difference between a DB and a DC then in regards to this subject.
Ms. Ferkel.
Mr. Chair and Representative, everything I've talked about today is defined benefit only. Defined contribution, however money gets put in, is what comes out of it. So there's always a consistency between the assets and the benefit. The assets are the benefit. There's no projection. There's nothing promised beyond we'll give you your money back after after it grows. So this really doesn't apply at all to a defined contribution plan. It really is only applicable to defined benefit plans.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ms. Ferkel, I'm not going to ask any more questions. However, one of the things they don't teach us in law school is when to stop talking. However, I'm looking at two things. First of all, the handout you've given us indicates the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, quote, of the Financial Accounting Foundation, unquote. Is that a separate entity? And in providing us the income, sources of income, and the expenditures of the great GASB. Will you trace that back to the Financial Accounting Foundation? I've never heard of it. Also, I'm curious, you know, I tend to get stuck on words. Paragraph 7 suggests that it's an independent body free from inappropriate political pressure or commercial influence. Does that mean that it's an independent body subject to appropriate political pressure and commercial influence?
Ms.
Burton. I'm done, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Financial Accounting Foundation has two branches. There's the Financial Accounting Standards Board, the FASB, which is develops accounting principles, generally accepted accounting principles for regular business, non-governmental, you know, regular big business. And then there is the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. So they got those two different branches that fall under the Financial Accounting Foundation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bogemiller.
I think we got to get a chuckle out of the plain English supplement to the exposure draft. I just think that's great. The plain English version. But one of the things in here notes that this is all relatively pretty new. They haven't really gotten into this business till 94. So I think, you know, a positive way to think about this is in terms of kind of best practices and uniformity of information across the country, this could be a good thing, too. I don't have an opinion on whether these particular moves are the right thing to do or not. I just It just seems to me better information, more timely, more uniform around the country is good for all of us.
We hear a lot about transparency, don't we? Any other questions? If not, Ms. Ferkel, thank you very much for being here today. And I don't know if any of the fund managers want to respond to the question. If you have any advice of things that we need to address short term here on this, or if we just let this play out over time. Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom from the Minnesota State Retirement System. I think, as Ms. Ferkel said, you know, this is an accounting standard. I think one thing the Pension Commission might want to look at is funding standards and develop those, because there will be a void there now. And, for example, MSRS, if we had an unfunded liability of $1 billion, that sounds like a lot, but if we're taking in contributions to fund that, you know, is our funding adequate? So I think it might be good for the Pension Commission to discuss sort of the funding standards it wants to use as you move forward, since GASB is more of an accounting standard, and now what would the Minnesota's funding standards be? And I'm not an expert on GASB, and I certainly don't want to answer any questions on it, but from my standpoint, I think that's something that you as a Pension Commission may want to discuss.
This is Chair Laurie Hacking with TRA. We've spent a lot of time on this GASB issue, and Mr. Bergstrom is correct. There is a void that's going to be created, and right now, already in our statutes, you have used largely GASB's current standards to determine whether we have a deficiency, to measure what our funding ratio is, all those things that you're very familiar with. With GASB's decision to divorce funding from accounting, we have to fill that gap. And you may just decide, after you think this through, that you want to keep with the current standards in terms of deciding or measuring what our funding ratios are, our deficiencies, and those sorts of things. I think that's probably worked pretty well in the past and would continue to do so. So you will have to think this through and make a conscious decision about how you direct our actuaries to calculate funding ratio deficiencies and those sorts of things. You could just decide to stick with the current statute. The other issue that I think you have to seriously think about is that there is going to be confusion because for the first time, school districts, cities, counties, et cetera, are going to have to show what will be probably fairly large numbers as liabilities. We've done some preliminary calculations at TRA, and some of the liabilities that show up will swamp the net asset position of most of these school districts, cities, counties. But in other words, this number is going to be very large. Now, so it's going to create confusion. What does that mean? Is the government in trouble because it's got this large? So there's going to have to be a lot of explaining of what these new numbers mean, and they're going to be more volatile, as Ms. Ferkel explained. They'll be more marked to market, so you will see more dramatic changes, a school district or a city, from one year to the next in what is shown as net pension liability. So, again, to get back to the funding issue, to us it seems important that we need to get out in front of this so that at the local level or state level, we can say, well, yes, that's the number under the current GASB standards, but here's what the funding situation is. And here's our funding standard, and, yes, this is the liability, but nonetheless we are 80% funded or whatever the number turns out to be. So I think this issue is going to be something you, the commission, will need to be working on. We're happy to help you through that process, and it probably needs to happen in advance of 2014 before this is implemented. I think, you know, it will need to be discussed and decided before then on your level.
So would you folks be prepared, or could you give us some recommendations on funding standards that that you think we ought to consider here as our policy or our approach?
I think we could. We'd need some time to do that, working with our actuaries, because it is, and with the OLA, it is a very complex area. And,
so maybe having it by November is not possible, but later?
Mr. Chair, well, actually, if it were November, it'd be kind of premature, because GASB will not finalize this until June of next year.
Okay.
So that it, this might be a good a project for the interim for the following year.
Mr. Bergstrom, is that would that be your recommendation?
Mr. Chair, I would agree totally.
So perhaps what we ought to do, Mr. Martin, is keep this on a future agenda topic that we would look at sometime after next session, next summer. Senator Rosen?
Mr. Chair, and to either Mr. Bergstrom or Mr. or Ms. Hacking, would this be much more simple if we were all city, counties, and schools were all on the same end of the year date? As Ms. Merkel was saying, this is you have different end of the year deadlines here, and I would think it would be a little more streamlined if we could.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I believe for the most part we are most of our districts, et cetera, are on the same fiscal year basis, and we don't.
With the state?
There may be a couple of outliers, but.
With the state, though, Ms. Hackett.
I'm sorry?
With the state.
The state of Minnesota, I think there's no problem.
Mr. Chair, I believe all of the entities we have would have a June 30th. So for the state and the University of Minnesota and the handful of employers we represent, I don't think it'll be an issue. It probably would be more of an issue for local government, which Ms. Vanek seems to be
shaking her head. Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, yes. City and county primarily are December 31st, so it's a significant issue if they're going to, if GASB is going to stay the course of having us calculate based on their fiscal year end when our pension fund fiscal year end is June 30th. That's a concern that's been raised with the board, the GASB, on having to recalculate all those numbers to comply with this.
Ms. Vanek, did you have anything further to add to
this? Mr. Chair, no, they've represented.
Okay. Any further questions or discussion? We will put this on a future agenda after next session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
at this point, before we move on to the next agenda item, we had at least a couple of people who have things that they wanted to address. Kim Crockett, and then right, and then I want to have the representative from the Duluth teachers who had a question follow up from yesterday's presentation. So, Ms. Crockett, would you you can proceed.
Good morning. I'm Kim Crockett, Minnesota Free Market Institute. My list of things were smoothing, amortization schedule, and then how that affects setting the assumed rate of return, which you spent a lot of time on yesterday. And given the presentation this morning, I think a lot of the issues that I wanted to raise are found within the GASB proposed draft changes and were covered well. So in the interest of time and so forth, I'm not going to go into the details on it. So I will promise to do this, anticipating the November meeting. I'll see if I can find some people who would be interesting to come in and do brief presentations and answer any questions that you might have. And just going through that list of three things. With smoothing, I believe Minnesota does a five-year smoothing, so we don't recognize changes in market returns in the year that they happen, but it gets pushed out 5 years. So we do participate in that smoothing to lower volatility, but it also doesn't give you as accurate a picture of where the funds are. And the amortization schedule, I think, as was observed, we do use 30 years. And I know I've had discussions with staff on how that works in Minnesota. I would not be the right person to go into the details. I believe Larry Martin and others are much better qualified to do that. So, again, that applies to us. And how this affects the assumed rate of return, just very quickly, I know we looked at the Vermont experiment yesterday where they're going to set their assumed rate of return very low initially, 6 or 6.5, and then climb to 9 over a period of many years. We've been discussing dropping it from 8.5, and I don't have a strong point of view as to what it should be. What I do understand is that has been criticized as this national debate
2%,
and one idea wherever you end up in terms of setting a new assumed rate of return should it change is to run a parallel study using those lower, more conservative rates between 4% and 6% to see where, testing the state of Minnesota and where it is in its assets and its promises. That's an alternative idea, and maybe that's part of what the GASB draft will require. But just as a way of saying kind of where are we really? What, on the promises that we've made already and our ability to deliver them. So while I understand the desire to do the careful work with the plans and study this very carefully in the interim, I think that there are things that the legislature ought to consider this upcoming session. And GASB is right on the doorstep with lots of giving you lots of time to think about it. But I would urge you to consider some of these items, looking at smoothing, the current way that we amortize, and the rate of return as ways of preparing for GASB. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Crockett, I'm not sure I understood what you were saying about the smoothing. Were you saying that the plans that use smoothing from Minnesota today are always using the years ahead rather than the years that just pass in the 5-year smoothing?
Ms. Crockett?
My understanding is that we smooth out what happened this year over the next 5 years. But again, I am not the best person to. I see the person sitting in front of me who could answer it better than I can. But and the idea is it gets rid of the volatility, but it also deprives you as the policy maker of understanding where the funds are and giving you that transparency. So exactly how that mechanism works is better left to an actuary or someone who understands it, such as Larry Martin.
Mr. Martin, do you want
Representative Murphy.
Members, if I could, we use a 5-year averaging in determining our actuarial value of assets. It's not a forward-looking. It's the last 5 years. It's what it basically is. It's not reducible to a real easy concept, but it's in its most simplified form, it's taking the difference each year between what would have been earned if we had earned the 8.5%, that's the actuarial assumption, and what actually is the performance is, and we take various percentages of that. So the difference between what should have been earned and what was earned for last year, we would take 20% of the difference in this given year. 2 years back, we would take 40% of that. We'd take 60% of the prior amount and 80% of the year before that. So we, on a escalator or elevator system, of recognizing the immediately prior 4 years, we pick up chunks of that. And so we ultimately take the full gain or full loss as it occurs, but we don't take it in immediate recognition.
Mr. Chair?
I think the five-year forward is probably a remnant of the notions. The post fund, when we had a post fund, we kept portions of the investment earnings in excess of 6.5%, and would place that. We would pigeonhole it for the future. We would project it forward and use it up in the future. And I think that's the four. To the extent there's some notion of forward averaging, that's probably where that comes from. For the actual accounting side of things, the actuarial value, since we don't know the future, we don't pay any attention to the future, we take the past 5 years and take portions of the differential between actual and what it should have been.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
That clarifies what I had understood. And so, thank you.
Senator Daley?
I'd like to draw your attention to slide 23 of Ms. Ferkel's presentation and ask Mr. Martin if you could comment on these proposed GASB changes and, based on what you just said, how that affects Minnesota in the center of that chart. It sounds very similar to what you just said. Slide 23, it's on page 8.
Well, you can read pretty small numbers. I have a hard time reading that small.
Senator Daley, I haven't specifically looked at recently the actual GASB language, and so this is a summary. But if it does, in fact, require a five-year smoothing or limit smoothing to a period no longer than 5 years, we use a five-year smoothing period. Very good chance that we conform.
So the change to the way we're doing things would be very minimal as far as actuarial evaluation. You mentioned 20% and 80%. Is that what this assumes?
Senator, as I understand the summary and as I understand GASB, they utilize a five-year averaging period, and we're recognizing the difference between market and our expected amount over a five-year period in increments. So there's a very good chance that we conform, but I really would have to sit down, or someone would have to really sit down with the actual GASB language and look at it to see if there are any clinkers.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps by November, I don't know how long that would take. Is it possible that you could research that and bring us that answer?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Martin, you had mentioned that there was another point relative to GASB that, as long as we're talking about that.
Members, the staff, to some extent, functions to serve as the institutional historians of the Pension Commission, and that's the role I'm taking at the moment. If you roll back to the earliest days of the Pension Commission, when it was still an interim commission, there were no generally accepted accounting principles per se. For pension plan financial reporting, there was no standards for actuarial work to speak of. The commission was in a new world to a certain extent. In 1965, when we first put together the actuarial reporting laws and first specified the entry age normal as the actuarial cost method and started specifying amortization periods, it was 1997 at that point. We also, for the first time, put together a requirement for annual financial reporting for the pension funds. That's still in statute, or at least its remnant is still there. It's Minnesota Statute Section 356.20, and that was a much longer statute back in those days. We've now, because we've by reference, have picked up generally accepted governmental accounting standards is the reference there. We have a lot less of the minutia, the portions of things that have to be reported. But the commission did wrangle with this back in the 60s, so this is not an absolutely brand new topic for the Pension Commission. We did enter this field when there wasn't generally accepted principles in either case and tried to establish some commonality for Minnesota pensions. So for what that's worth, that's the institutional history.
It's always good to have somebody who knows that history. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I need to write it down.
Yes, yes. Thank you very much. Anything else, Ms. Crockett?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative from Duluth Teachers.
Mr. Stoffel,
welcome, and thank you for raising the question. You wanted to be able to respond to something that was presented yesterday.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jay Stoffel, Director of the Duluth Teachers Fund, and I just thought I would just take a short moment to make two points. When your actuary, Milliman, was here yesterday, there was a page related to the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund actuarial valuation. And the first comment was that our actuary, which is the Siegel Company, needs to do something a little bit different to fully calculate the liability for active members. And I understand that something's been identified in the way our actuary does the calculation. And Milliman has been in contact with our actuary, the Siegel Company, to sort through that issue. And I just wanted to assure you that we're working on that, and we'll have that taken care of for the valuation for June 30, 2011, which we're working on currently. The second thing I wanted to point out is that you expressed an interest, Mr. Chair, about funds that had not aren't part of that, I think it's a quadrennial experience study process. Our last experience study was done 2007. We're not part of that quadrennial cycle. But the last time we did an experience study was 2007, and we intend to do one following the valuation for June 30, 2011, which means this winter we'll be doing another experience study. We tend to do it about every 5 or 6 years. It's costly. It's going to cost us about $25,000 to do that. We've contracted with Siegel to do it already. Whether you do it 4, 5, 6 years is kind of a judgment call, and we tend to do it on a 5 to 6 year cycle, just for your information.
Thank you very much. Representative Kahn.
Just the question, is the Siegel Company the Martin Siegel Company, or is it different from that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I don't believe so. It's the name is simply the Siegel Company. It's not the other one you mentioned.
Thank you, Mr. Stoffel. Appreciate that. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard relative to this agenda item on GASB? If not, we'll move on to the next item on the agenda. Ms. Vanek. Welcome again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. Before I get to this item, I just would also like to take the opportunity, Mr. Chair, to comment on the discussion yesterday about having experience studies done on the smaller plans.
Okay.
As Mr. Martin shared with you, we have completed one for General and the Police and Fire Fund recently. Our correctional plan has never had an experience analysis done. It's a relatively new plan. You created it in 1999. We are, though, intending to ask our actuary to do an experience analysis of that plan following this year's valuation, primarily because of the issue of mortality assumptions. They have changed significantly for our other two plans, and we think it's important now. There's only 500 benefit recipients, 3,500 active members, but it's still maybe a good time to check in and do that analysis and get all our plans in sync on the more progressive amortization or mortality schedule, if in fact that is the prudent thing to do. So we'll be reporting back to you on that.
Thank you.
With respect to this issue, I would like to point out that I have a staff person, Linda Havel, with me, and I'm going to do the presentation. I've got her here to help answer questions if you have questions about recent experience, because she's going to be getting more involved in legislative activities, so you can see the new face that Para will have. And because she's now handling directly those entities that are looking at changing their status to non-governmental. The handout is going to go over a history of how this the statute was created and what led to it, and raise for you a couple of issues that we have encountered since, number one, we changed our deferred augmentation rates in the 2010 bill for our regular plan, and number two, a provision that's been brought to our attention by individuals who are subject to these higher augmentation rates through this statute, but who have returned to public employment, and that there's a provision in this law that's creating an issue for them. First of all, just to remind those of you who are here and those of you who may not be familiar with this, this chapter was enacted for PERA in 1999. It was modeled after the exact same benefit provisions that existed for MSRS in their Chapter 352F, which was created in 1996. However, in MSRS, they've only experienced one employer who has gone to a non-governmental status and is subject to these enhanced benefits. PERA currently has 23 subject to the enhanced benefits, and we have three others that are currently looking at it. The additional local government entities, we have four entities that are in process. Prior to 1999, when a county or a city hospital decided to move out of the business of running a medical facility and linked with a nonprofit or a non-governmental group, the provisions of our benefit structure that existed for any public employee that left governmental service is what they were entitled to. Under the laws, you were no longer eligible to be covered by PERA because you're no longer working for a governmental entity, and so you are subject to whatever our benefits were. Now, if they were vested and not yet retirement age, they were entitled to whatever our deferred retirement augmentation rates were that were in place. If they were non-vested, they could take their employee money plus contributions out of the plan. As different entities started to move in the direction of leaving the business of medical and nursing home care, several of them came before the legislature for special legislation. And that special legislation included such things as not only allowing just the employee contribution refund, but also allowing the employer matching contribution refund to be paid. And at one point, the legislature got concerned that, well, we shouldn't just be giving this money, the employer money, directly to them to spend. It's going to be allowed to refund the employer match, at a minimum, we should put it into an IRA. So there were a few small entities where it was required by law that if the people were going to take their employer contribution refund, they had to set up an IRA if they didn't already have one. Didn't work real well. There was a lot of pushback. There were some banks that were setting up IRAs that were concerned because the people wanted to grab the money out right away and they were going to have to pay penalties anyway, and so we got some pushback on that. And please understand that most of these arrangements were not something that were recommended by PERA. They were things that were brought to the Legislative Commission by other parties. In 1986, the big issue was St. Paul Ramsey Hospital was restructuring as a public corporation. And there we had questions out to Department of Labor and folks about whether or not these folks could, in fact, stay in PERA. And the decision was made at that point in time that the former St. Paul Ramsey Hospital employees who were already in PERA, if they chose, could stay there. But no new hires, once they became a public corporation, could be covered. And then several years later, I think it was about 10 years later, Ramsey Hospital converted from a public corporation to a nonprofit corporation. And then it was very clear to us that they were no longer governmental. However, again, the few hundred employees that remained came to the legislature and said, please, can we stay in PERA? We requested a determination from the Department of Labor on whether or not we were going to be impacted as a governmental plan for covering non-governmental employees, but we were told that because it was a de minimis number compared, it was a small number compared to our overall membership, it wasn't going to cause us to lose our IRS tax deferred status, but that we would, that we should not allow continuing to add or allow people who were no longer governmental to stay in the plan going forward. So that was an experience. In the mid 90s, there was a law written to say that the new employer should attempt to replicate the pension coverage that would be made available to these people who were losing their para coverage. And I only worked with one group that did that, and that was Mayo was taking over the operations of Olmsted County Hospital. And they went through a very extensive study with an actuarial firm to see how they should replace benefits for the people that were losing their para coverage. And I believe that those over 40 were offered a defined benefit plan, and those under 40 were offered a defined contribution plan with a little bit better contribution or higher contribution. So that was another model. In 1999, the legislature saw, I think, three bills. I remember two of them, Glencoe and Laverne. And they worked with pension commission staff, and the provisions of those hospitals modeled the legislation that was passed for MSRS in 1996. And in that discussion, it was decided that PERA would now have a chapter, which we refer to as 353F, which was exactly modeling what had been done for MSRS when the University of Minnesota Hospital employees became employees of Fairview. So since 1999, we have been operating under what's called 353F. And the intent of that was to use the value of the, to look at what would the liability be to PERA if these employees were allowed to stay in para. What would ultimately be our liability for the benefits earned by these individuals? Compare that to the liability that we already had, assuming those people stopped coverage on a date certain because of the privatization, and then compare that to what does providing these enhanced features under 353F, which is a higher augmentation rate, and a couple of other smaller things, but that was the primary one. What is that? What would that cost? And if the cost of allowing them to have those enhanced features was less than the cost of leaving them in para, what we would have otherwise experienced, then they automatically got the enhancement. That doesn't work anymore. Because under PERA, with the 2010 sustainability legislation, our board recommended some changes in what a terminating PERA member will receive in terms of a deferred benefit in the future. And that's a much lower benefit value than this enhanced feature provided in 353F for these folks who are in with employers that are going private. While we were looking at that, it was brought to our attention that there is a current provision in 353F that isn't, that's been included in information that we give to people covered by this chapter, but that isn't well understood, and is the, and we have no way of really finding out when this happens. And what it is that if somebody who is working for a nursing home or hospital that has gone private, who is expecting that they're going to get this higher interest on their deferred benefit, if that individual leaves that entity and goes to work for either a current PERA employer or an employer covered by one of the other funds in the in the system, TRA, MSRS, they totally lose those enhanced interest rates on their benefit. And the value of the benefit that they were expecting is going to be much less compared to what it would have been had they not gone to work in another public entity. And I'll show you an example of that. So I have two issues to share with you today. Number one, 353F, as it was originally designed, is no longer working. And number two, there is a feature of it that I promised the two individuals who came to us who are pretty unhappy with the fact that they weren't aware that their benefits were going to be lower because they went to work elsewhere after they left this private entity. So I promised I'd share that. On the handout on page four, on the top slide, seven, it just gives you a snapshot of what these interest rates are. And from 1989 until the passage of the 2010 pension sustainability bill, for any person who left PERA-covered service and went to work elsewhere outside the public system, they're entitled to receive interest on the benefit that they had earned through their date of termination of service, 3% on that benefit up to age 55, and 5% after age 55 to the date that they start collecting it. 353F was originally designed to instead pay 5.5% on the value of the benefit the member had earned until age 55 and 7.5% beyond age 55. PERA asked the actuary to look at that in late 2005 because what we learned is that the 5.5 and 7.5 was designed for MSRS when they were 98% funded, and we were not 98% funded. So we asked for the actuary to come back with a recommendation to the LCPR on what would be a more reasonable rate given our funded status. And so beginning in 2006, those privatized employees were entitled to 4% on that benefit up till an age 55 and 6% thereafter. Now in the current world, that's still overly generous in terms of the cost to the system. One other thing that's included in this, in the 353F provisions, is that anyone who was a pre-July 1, 89 member is entitled to Rule of 90 benefits. Anybody with an entry date after that doesn't get that. We all are aware Rule of 90 has gone away. So we have some people who may be working for a hospital that's going private, and they're terminating, the hospital's going private on January 1st, 2010, and all their projections have said that on January 1st, 2012, they meet the Rule of 90. Well, because they can't accrue service in the system anymore, that projection that we have told them in the past, that they're going to get to Rule of 90 in 2012, is no longer valid if they were a regular deferred member. In the privatization plan, we still recognize that January 1st, 2012 is their Rule of 90 date. So we say, okay, we'll recognize your continued employment with this private hospital now to get you to your Rule of 90, but we do not include those additional 2 years in the calculation of their benefit. So essentially, they get an unreduced benefit as if they had met the Rule of 90, but we only give them a benefit based on their actual years, not the 2 years with the private hospital. That is part of this 353F provision that is pretty important to a lot of the folks, because it's every group we have worked with, there have been at a minimum three or four people who are pre-89 who are counting on still having access to Rule of 90. On the bottom slide, I'm going to give you an example of how this was intended to work. A recent privatization out of Steele County, Cedar View Nursing Home, the calculation shows that if these individuals had stayed in para, the liability accrued to para, if everybody worked to when they were assumed, the accrued liability was $4.5 million. If they terminated under our regular benefit package at that point in time, the cost to para was $3.8 million. Giving them the enhanced benefits, the 4% and 6%, and recognizing rule of 90 for those who would have otherwise been eligible, the cost is roughly $4.3 million. So in this case, because the liability that's been determined that would have been paid, that para would have incurred if these people stayed in, is more than the liability associated with giving them the higher termination package, the higher augmentation rates. Since there's a positive difference there for PERA, these folks got privatization. They got to go out, and these employees are going to get the 4%, 6% recognition for Rule of 90. On page, losing track here, on page 5, we give you a snapshot of what those benefits look like. So we did a calculation prior to, I feel like I'm explaining GASB here. It's complicated. Prior to 2010 sustainability legislation, a member leaving PERA, I decide to leave employment in the public sector and go elsewhere, and I earned a benefit at age 55 of $1,000 a month. Under the augmentation for a person who just voluntarily or for some reason leaves public service, by age 65, with the 5% augmentation rate, would be entitled to a benefit of $1,629 a month. The privatized employee who loses benefit, additional future coverage in PERA at age 55, with a benefit at that point of $1,000 a month, by 65, with the 6% augmentation feature, is going to get $1,791 a month. Then the PERA board recommended to you in 2010 to change those provisions. So for anyone who for a provision effective for 1/1/2012, the augmentation rate for a normal deferred member who's already terminated before the end of this year is 1% going forward. So instead of $1,000 a month at age, the $1,000 a month at age 55 becomes $1,105 a month at age 65 with a 1% augmentation rate. Again, the deferred member under privatization, same benefit. After the end of this year, our law now says that anybody leaving public employment who is deferring receipt of their benefit's frozen. There's no augmentation. So if I choose to leave PERA in March of 2012 and I choose not to draw my benefit until I'm 65, my benefit's going to be exactly the same at age 65, 5.5 years later, as it is when I walk out the door in March. That's how our provisions currently read. But in the privatization statute, they still get the 6% augmentation from age 55 on, or 4% before that. So the benefit's more expensive. In essence, what we did for our regular plan members in 2010 has now made the 353F features inoperable. The calculation's going to produce a net loss, and unless the employer decides to pay to para the cost of the higher benefit, the individuals go out with just our regular package of benefits. Currently, we have been working with Sunrise Nursing Home in Lake County. They did go private January 1st this year, 2011. Okay. Virginia Medical Center is looking at moving to a nonprofit administration. They have asked to have the calculation done. They are interested in what the cost would be if it's higher to add these benefits. We're a little nervous. They got a lot of long service folks. So our feeling is the cost is probably going to end up being prohibitive, but we're working through the calculation with our actuary currently. St. Michael's Hospital in Sauk Center has contacted us. They're looking at going to a nonprofit administrator, so they'll become non-governmental, and they want to know if the legislature is going to do anything with this chapter to make this accessible for their employees. And Clearwater County Hospital, which is already listed in the statute as being eligible for this, didn't complete their process in time. So they're not eligible for the benefits, and they have to restart the process. And we've told them don't do the actuarial work because we're confident that I've looked at their numbers, and all their short service people have left. It's all their long service people that have stayed, and those benefits are going to be more costly. And so it's probably have to pay to let them have this enhancement if, in fact, they're going to go forward. So the question we have posed to you is,
I'm looking at the sheet.
Privatizations just be subject to our normal termination benefits, which is 0% augmentation after this year. Do you want to provide a higher rate, something between zero and what is currently being provided, that is affordable within that structure that was originally created? And another question that I know your staff asked me, which I didn't address with our board when we were going through the 2010 legislation, was should we lower what we're paying to those people who are already in deferred status that privatized? Because we did that to our existing deferred members. We said, okay, you can keep your 3 and 5 through 2011, but after 2011, it goes to 1% until you start collecting. We did not do that with the privatized employees. Actually, I just didn't have the time to get all the work done to present to the board. On page 6, slide 12, it shows you what we tested with Sunrise Lake Nursing Home. And this is where it shows you where, for Sunrise Lake Nursing Home, if they had stayed in para, our cost would have been roughly $1.7 million to provide benefits to them. Mm-hmm. If leaving and not getting anything more than we normally provide, the cost would be $1.3 million to PERA. And if they wanted to give them the enhancements under 353F, the cost was $1.9 million, more than ongoing. So a couple hundred thousand dollars more that the Sunrise Lake Nursing Home or the successor entity would have had to pay to PERA to give them these benefits. They chose not to do that. So we tested a 1% augmentation. So the options for you to look at here are that if we would give them a 1% augmentation for all their years of privatization, our liability would be $1.275 million. If you give them a 2% augmentation, it would be roughly $1.4 million. Both of those figures, again, are less than what it would be if they had ongoing membership in PERA. So they're just some options to consider. I did ask Representative Smith and Senator Rosen just to introduce a bill by request. Our board landed at allow them to continue to have the recognition of Rule 90, allow them to continue to have immediate vesting, but they took the position that they shouldn't get any more augmentation than anybody else who's terminating. And it's really a fairness issue to current folks who are leaving public employment, because while these individuals are losing their para service because the employer is deciding to change their structure, a lot of other folks are losing their para-covered service because they're being laid off because of what's going on. That's not, we're not here to make a judgment call on what it should do. The Legislative Commission asked PERA to assume the 353F provisions back in 1999. We just said, okay, we understand why you're asking for a common model to be applied to any entities that are moving forward toward privatization. It's just that we didn't anticipate at the time, nor I don't think did the commission, that there would be so many of them. And PARA experiences them every single year. One or two of them were coming to you to say, this group went private, add them to the list in the statute. So that's the one question. The other question relates to the individuals who were part of this privatized hospital, continued to work, left, and we don't know they leave until after they leave, and then they go to work in a plan covered by PARA or an employer covered by PARA or another plan. On page 7, slide 14, this is an example of somebody we just dealt with. This person came to our office with an application for retirement effective October 1st. She had been working with Hutchinson Hospital, which was subject to the higher augmentation rates, the 5.5 and 7.5. After she left there, however, she did some very minimal teaching that subjected her to TRA coverage. And we didn't know about it until she applied for her benefits and we asked a few questions and we said, oh, you don't get 5.5 and 7.5 because you had subsequent service covered by one of the Minnesota pension plans. So she gave me permission to just use her situation as an example. So on slide 14, you can see that under 353F, with the 5.5 and 7.5% augmentation rates, she was expecting a benefit of about $2,878 a month. Her TRA benefit standing alone, because she had minimal service with them, was another $25 a month. So she was anticipating, based on estimates she'd received over time, a benefit of about $2,900 a month. When we found out that she was reemployed in public sector, we had to take away the augmentation rates under 353F because that's what the provision says. So we calculated her benefit from PERA as a standalone benefit, which means we could give her 3 and 5%. We just couldn't give her 5.5 and 7.5% augmentation. So that calculation gave her a benefit of $2,635 a month. And again, TRA separately calculated the benefit. She'd get $25 from them. So her total payment, $2,660. If we use combined service where we take the highest salary and both funds use the highest salary, PARA's benefit would have been $2,179. TRA's would have gone up to $51, but the net total was less. So we advised her that under current law, what we were allowed to pay her was $2,660. She was expecting $2,903. She's viewing that as that wasn't intended. And I think if I can interpret correctly, and I'd ask Mr. Martin, Mr. Burke, who were involved in writing the statute, I think what was intended was that if people left and went to another job and started accruing service in the plans again, were working regular full-time work, that salary had the potential of being a higher salary and giving them more years of service and a better benefit than they expected that. Well, you don't pay augmentation to somebody who comes back into the system and starts accruing service and you count that new salary toward their benefit. We don't do that normally, and it wasn't intended to be done under this provision. But in this case, this woman got kind of caught. She didn't tell us she had been teaching a few hours every 6 weeks and earning credit in TRA. So when we found that out, we told her, we can't pay you this higher benefit. On the other side of the coin, on the last slide, on page 8, is another situation we ran into. And this person, again, worked at Glencoe. And she was then entitled to the 5.5 and 7.5% augmentation rates. But she left and she went to work for a public hospital currently covered by PERA. So she's paying in, accruing service, but she was banking on the higher augmentation rates on her benefit for just her Glencoe service. So in this and she's not retirement age yet, so we did some projections for her. And under this scenario, if she were to get the higher augmentation rates at age 59, her benefits would be roughly, she'd get a monthly benefit of just under $1,100 a month. At age 60, it'd be $1,250. Without the augmentation rates under 353F, and just counting her additional years of service, the whole way we calculate a normal benefit for somebody, her benefit drops to 782 versus 875 between 59 and 60. And if we calculated it separately, like the law allows us to do, and give her deferred augmentation at 3 and 5% under our normal rules, instead of the 1,096, she'd get 925 at age 59 or 1,036 at age 60. So it just gives you an idea that there is that augmentation feature, that higher augmentation feature, can lead to a couple hundred dollars a month difference in the benefit that people are expecting. I advised both of these individuals that our board heard from one of them, and our board really said, we're not going to take a position on this one way or the other. This was a provision written in the statute, and if the commission wants to address it, we really need to ask you whether or not you want to do something differently with that. I do know that the one individual that just recently retired, if something isn't done, she probably will be in front of you with special legislation, because she just felt, understandably, you know, she wasn't aware. She said she wouldn't have gone back and taught a class at the local community college for a few hours once every 6 weeks had she really been aware that this was going to impact her benefit like it did. So I'm sorry, I presented a couple of confusing issues to you, but the bottom line is we can't pay 4% to age 55 and 6% thereafter to these folks anymore and it be affordable within the structure. And the second thing is individuals are being impacted by this little-known provision where they lose their augmentation altogether. So maybe one of the options would be to give them the augmentation up to the point where they've left that private entity instead of all the way to their full to their retirement age. I don't know. It's just a thought. And I know that Mr. Beerick has done a memo on this in the past. He sent me some questions he had, so I guess I have to defer to your staff if they have any advice to give you on it. Lots to think about. I'm sorry. It's a confusing issue.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, for Ms. Bennett, for clarification, review with me again the one that went teaching.
Yes.
How did she leave her employment? She wasn't ready for retirement yet, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I believe that throughout, she had other TRA service because throughout her working career, I believe she was a nurse, she had often been asked to teach courses at the local college in nursing. So she had been doing that while she was employed at the medical center. And then she left the medical center and was asked to come back and teach one or two more times. And in doing so, she was terminated with the medical center, but now was earning service under TRA. So we didn't know that she was teaching at the local college. So we couldn't advise her that it was totally taking away that higher augmentation feature, because she wasn't doing it simultaneously while she was employed at the medical center anymore. She did it after she left there, but before she applied for her retirement.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, did we know that she wasn't working at the medical center?
Ms. Manning?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I don't. remember. I can check on that for you. But I don't think that we yet knew that. I don't think she had notified us.
And she was terminated or did she choose? By her free will, or did she just quit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, she was retirement age, so she decided to retire. And she...
But she didn't check into her retirement possibilities until after she was done?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, you know what? I don't remember. It was all happened within a very short period of time where she made the application. We checked it out. Then she notified us that she had taught at the college after she left the medical center, and it's once she told us that, it triggered that, well, there's this provision that says you lose this higher augmentation because you did that.
Ms. Bennett, does the bill that's already been introduced, does that fix the problem, or does that bill that's been introduced need to be further changed or amended to address the issues you're referring to?
Mr. Chair, the bill that's been introduced represents the para board's position that that individuals who are working for entities that go private shouldn't get any more in terms of augmentation than our regular plan members do who leave on their own or through layoff. So it takes them to zero starting January 1st. They get no augmentation whatsoever. It does not address this issue with respect to coverage in a plan subsequent to employment at the privatized hospital. It doesn't address the individual's situations that I've raised.
Mr. Chair.
So you're suggesting that there needs to be other legislation drafted in order to address this?
Mr. Chair, I think it's a decision by the commission on... The board really said, you know, we didn't design 353F initially. Their position was, well, we've taken deferred augmentation out of our package completely for future terminating members, and whether the commission still believes that there should be some augmentation feature for these people who are under an employer and are being forced to lose their coverage because it's an employer's decision to privatize. Whether or not that discussion needs to be had at the commission level, the board really kind of deferred to you on that. From their perspective, we didn't think we'd treat them any differently than normally terminating members, other than recognition of getting to Rule of 90 for those that otherwise would have gotten there. So that's really a policy decision that we're kind of leaving to the commission. With respect to the individuals who lose their higher augmentation, again, I think it's a policy decision, and your staff may be better able to give you some history on how that got written into the law. This is we've run into this half a dozen times where people have left and gone to work in a para-covered job again, and at least then we know when we are aware of it, we notify them. But if they're still working for a while, oftentimes their benefit's going to be better because now they're earning additional service credit, their salary's higher than it was, and they're in a better situation. But for these two individuals, they're not in a better situation, and so they're frustrated with that.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, just quick, given the options here, is there an option that she could have just, after she found this out, she could just say, well, I'll get
reasonable
the TRA, the $25 a month, and I can take the $2,800. There's no option, or does that make any sense to them?
Ms. Bannick?
Mr. Chair, Senator Chamberlain, she was required to be covered by TRA. There's no optional opportunity there on whether she's covered or not.
Senator Rosen?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, Ms. Bannick, then... But you said she was working she was doing some teaching while she was in the hospital, though, too. So is she eligible for TRA for that time served at that time? Or do you just have to choose a pension plan at that time?
Again, Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, she had accrued her service with TRA for that earlier time.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the fact that she was then only covered by TRA after she left the hospital and she was required to contribute to TRA that she got kind of caught there because the 353F says if you are again covered by one of the Minnesota pension plans, you are not entitled to these higher augmentation rates. It's not like she had an option. Had she known that going to teaching before she started collecting her retirement would have impacted her, I'm sure she would have made a different choice, but she wasn't aware of it. And
Representative Giffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Thanik, this pertains, I think, when we were meeting in the legislative our commission during session and some other times. Some of these questions also on special circumstances came up. And the discussion was centering around opportunities for employees to know the impact of their pension decisions. So in this particular case, I know there were some of those discussions, the fact that the employee says, I didn't know, I think the question that's more important to us is, did she have the opportunity to know? If I recall right, there are some times along the way when it regards pensions that I know that we get information sent to us and other kinds of things going on. So the question is, saying you didn't know, but there's still an individual responsibility when you're making some of these decisions to know. It's a critical time. But so what's kind of the process in these situations and opportunities that you give to employees so that they can know their situation?
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, we put together informational material when these groups originally privatized. In the case of the both of these cases, the privatizations occurred several years ago. So we gave them material, and we started sending individual benefit statements to them within the last 2 years?
Yes.
2 years automatically. Otherwise, they had to request them. We had to figure out a way to program it and get everybody adequately informed. But it is a... It's listed in our literature, and we were able to show the person who came to our board last spring that it was in a handout we gave to you. It was in a presentation we gave. She said, I don't think I went to your presentation. Well, you know, and it's unfortunate, especially for her case. She was Glencoe and was the very first one to be under these provisions, so it was new for all of us. But that being said, we don't have a good way of knowing when exactly these people leave and go elsewhere until it's already done. In that woman's case, she left Glencoe, and we didn't know that until the following month she showed up being reported from a different county hospital, and now she was re-enrolled in PERA. And then it was brought to our attention that, whoa, you now are not covered by these privatization provisions any longer because you're re-enrolled in PERA. And the person that just left and just came in and applied, it was all very close together where she left the hospital, she took the teaching assignment, and then she came in and applied for her benefits following her 65th birthday, and then it all unfolded. So we try to keep them informed. It's on the website. It's in material. But it is one of those little-known provisions that get lost.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that I know the efforts that you do go through in working hard to inform employees and their due diligence responsibilities if they choose not to attend and they make those decisions and thereby have consequences. I don't know that it's always up to the employer or other entities to fix things that they aren't always knowing about. And yet, you know, we're always sensitive to surrounding circumstances that may have a reason for us to give understanding to that. But I do think it's important that on the record here we clarify that the efforts that you do make to inform employees and consequences and things that they put out are rather significant efforts that you do make on behalf of them to make sure you make it as smooth as you can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions, it would seem to me then that what may need to be considered here then is a new or additional proposed legislation that we would consider as a commission. I don't know that this is an issue that, because we're talking about a change in statute, that we are in a position to take any action on this today, are we?
Mr. Chair, if it's all right, we could work with staff and have some discussions with them so they could give you some alternatives that we all think are at least reasonable. I know that Mr. Burke has worked on this issue when I asked him to draft last year's the bill introduced by Senator Rosen and Representative Smith, and we had some discussion on it. So we could move forward working with them if you'd like and see if they can present you some options.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, members, as we indicated, we wanted to spend some time before we adjourn today figuring out our agenda for next time, which is November 9th and 10th. Let me give you a list of items that I've been noting as we've gone along that are candidates for being on the November 9th and 10th agenda. And I'll go through my list, and I'll invite all of you to add to the list, and then let's have some discussion about what should be included or not. In terms of the issue of hybrids involving defined contribution options or ideas, we still have on our list to hear something about Roth, to hear something about the Nebraska option, to inquire further about the Vermont alternatives that we heard about yesterday. So there are several pieces of hybrid options, maybe other hybrid options that people have thought of or whatever. So that's one thing. Also from yesterday, we said we wanted to come back and take a look at the need for experience studies, where those studies should be encouraged or required. We identified the question about whether or not there needs to be any change in this greater than 90% COLA policy. I'm unclear from our discussion before as to where we might want to consider going with that. We have yet to consider or get the information about private sector trends. That was on our list along the way. Yesterday, we got feedback from Dr. Stinson on the assumption for growth or earnings assumptions, but he was not prepared to address the other assumptions, such as salary growth and employee assumption and growth assumptions. We had indicated along the way that we wanted to hear from possibly from NCSL, an expert who could tell us what other states are looking at by way of pension reform issues. Mr. Bergstrom gave me this morning issues and trends paper prepared by Keith Brainerd from NASRA. And he is available on November 10th, which is a Thursday. And so we could not only have someone from NCSL, but also Mr. Brainerd that would be with us to talk about what's happening and other elsewhere. I had mentioned yesterday that it would be good to have before us a listing of all the bills that have been introduced in this session that are kind of before us. They're on the table. Not that we are going to go through those bills, but at least to, again, have in front of us all of what's out there that we're going to have to make a decision on hearing those bills come January. That is my list. What else have you thought of or do you have on your list? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple of addendums to your list.
Okay.
In the sense that for things that you mentioned. You said on the experience studies that we should discuss that further. Could we also discuss what mortality tables are used now? Somebody yesterday said somebody was still using the 1983 mortality table. And then I asked a couple people and asked what mortality tables they were using, and they were more recent, but still not in the 2000s. And so I don't know how you pick a mortality table even, but if we could have a little more additional information about what mortality tables are being used and why.
And to what extent there's an old table that's being used. We heard at least one case of it.
And then my...
Just a minute. Mr. Martin, is that something we can readily attain in terms of what the...
Well, members, in the packet, in the large document that I prepared for you for the October meeting, the mortality assumptions that are currently being used by each of the plans is set forth there.
Okay.
Some of our plans do use a 1983 group annuity mortality table. Smaller plans, judges, for instance, legislators,
okay.
Don't use the RP 2000 table that was approved for MSRS General, PERA General, and TRA previously. So that information, we can isolate it out for you and give it to you in a different presentation form, but the information's there. The normal working or the way the actuary works with doing a mortality table is they look at the current table and what they're expecting for mortality, look at actual mortality, and they try and square the two up, and they will modify that table by doing setbacks or set forwards. If somebody who's 65 looks like they have really the mortality of someone who's 55, they would do a 10-year setback. If the mortality is greater than what would have been predicted by that old table, they'll do a set forward. They might take the person, instead of considering only 65, they would be 67. So they adjust these by setbacks and setbacks at various ages. So, or by gender, I think, is the more typical. So because a table is old, it doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't reflect a pattern that can't be adjusted upward or downward. And so just because it's a dated table doesn't necessarily mean that it's necessarily inappropriate. It certainly can be. A 1910 mortality table is probably not going to give you a pattern that looks anything like current patterns. It's going to be presumably much, much flatter and then ends. It's probably different now, but... And we have Milliman here if you want to have them give you some greater sense about what's going on. So simply the date on the table doesn't necessarily mean it's inappropriate, but is the pattern correct? If we don't do experience studies, and we don't do experience studies in a fair number of our plans at the moment, no one ever rigorously goes through and checks this. We haven't done a mortality table. We haven't done an experience study for the judges' plan, for instance, since the mid-'90s, presumably. The last I recall seeing one. So if we never bother to square the table up and we're using an old table, that's the problem. It's the fact that we haven't made any attempt to accommodate more recent experience.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll go back to that October memo. And
we can easily produce
for you. I'll
forget
the tone of voice that was said. and just accept that. So,
okay.
Good. My second point was, and you referred to it in your comments about more information on the Vermont plan. I don't think I'm really interested in particular in more information on that plan, because it seemed like it was so fast and they were just having the time period for such a short time that I don't know that I want to go there on the select and ultimate rates. But I was wondering if there was someone in that has a plan that would be willing to think about it and volunteer to explore how they would do a select and ultimate rate option for their plan if they wanted to go with it a little bit further and share that information with us.
Okay.
And I thought maybe there would be a volunteer, okay, or two or five. But I wanted maybe just one or two, just to see what they come up with.
Okay.
And I see Mr. Stoffel moving.
Mr. Stoffel.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, thank you for that idea. I have talked to our contact at the Siegel Company, which I have since learned since my last testimony actually is the Martin Siegel Company. So I correct those who were mentioned. But our actuary would be willing and able and happy to provide some research on select and ultimate. And if we wanted to present something, that how it would affect our plan, we would be willing to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
November, I guess the next set of meetings are 2 days in November.
November 9 and 10.
9 and 10. Okay. Thank you.
Afternoon of the 9th, the morning of the 10th.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, Laurie Hacking with TRA, we too would be very interested in providing okay. that. Our actuary had made a presentation to our board about that in September, and I think we're keenly interested. So we'd be a volunteer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I should have probably prefaced my list here by saying this is a list of things that along the way we've talked about hearing more about or having more information about. Obviously, the big item that I didn't mention was the whole issue of the interest rate earnings assumption of 8.5%. I don't know that we need any further presentation on that. What we need is some good, solid discussion as a commission about where we're going to go with that issue. And so just that as a clarification here. Other things that you would put on the list? Senator Daley.
Mr. Chairman, just for additional clarity, the recent, number seven, recent trends in private sector retirement plans, do you have any specific thing in mind? And I guess if you did not, what I was going to suggest, a possibility of perhaps 3M, General Mills, U.S. Bank, Xcel Energy, and a private sector, or not a publicly owned company, but a privately owned company, Cargill, perhaps those entities might be interested in sharing some of their experiences if you're looking for details from specific companies.
Yeah, that's, yes, that's in tune with what I was suggesting. That's one thing we haven't heard much about yet in terms of private sector experience and trends.
And I'll talk with you offline after the meeting about coordinating those details.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, this probably isn't appropriate for the November meeting, but I'm kind of interested about what you're trying to, what your thoughts are on assembling the pension bill for the next session and what your thoughts are, how many individual bills we have now that we didn't deal with yet and that are appropriate to be dealt with, because as we've always found out, particularly if this is going to be a short and rushed session, it's very difficult to find the pension commission meeting time and the time to be able to have it. And the thought, if we could get our bill assembled before the session really starts, could be very helpful. And I think My colleague reminded me that's what Senator Betzel did last time, but I think he was a little too rigorous about not saying that anything could be presented if it hadn't been considered before. But the idea is, are there some things we could, some easier things we could consider before and get it done? I mean, we've had terrific attendance at all of these meetings.
Yes.
And so it's obviously much easier than during session for us.
Good, for sure. I would hope that in terms of significant issues that are more than just individual,
right,
that by the end of our meeting on the 10th,
okay,
that we could have an outline of what are the items that we think we'd like to include in an omnibus bill, so that then we can be about the business of drafting something that we would have before us right away at the beginning of the session, or before the session started. And we will have all of the bills that have already been introduced. We'll have those in front of us next time. And so we'll have a sense of that. And as I think I had mentioned before, given the possibility of a very short 10-week session or thereabouts, that any bills that we're going to hear, probably we ought to start hearing bills right away. And maybe all of us, I think, pretty much know our committee schedule, so maybe we can even plan to find a time that works for everybody.
Lots of luck.
Got lots of luck, I know, but we can try anyway. So that's what I've had in mind, if that sounds reasonable. Other thoughts or items? Representative Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chair, just referring back to what Ms. Vanek's last presentation was, I guess I would just as soon, rather than just discuss again and then go toward I would just as soon like to see the amendment for 353 that she indicated that we would need to make that change. I mean, that's a definite change we're going to have to make.
Sure.
And if it was an amendment form, I think it might be easier. Or as when we get the memos, you know, usually we have several suggested amendments.
I think if staff are prepared to work up an option or two with regard to that amendment that addresses these issues, then we'll have that before us as a potential legislation or something to include in the omnibus bill. Any other ideas? I'm not sure. I don't know that we've got time to cover this whole list. If we want to have significant discussion time, and is there anything on that list that you think is not of high enough priority to try and work it in? Getting additional information or whatever? If not, Representative Kiffmeyer?
Right. I think, Mr. Chairman, they're all of great interest. I would rather have at least a smaller amount of time, but cover them all. To just exclude any of them seems like we're at a critical time right now, so I'd rather at least
have something. Yeah. Well, several on this list I think could be fairly concise and not take a lot of time. Dr. Stinson, I'm sure, will do like he did yesterday and be short and to the point with what his analysis would be. So if you're okay with this, I can work with staff and try to manage this to at least have some information on each of these items, but making sure we save a significant block of time for discussion. And I would hope that we could save at least 2 to 3 hours of just commission discussion time. Mm-hmm. And another thing that I'm willing to do and would be happy to do is to between now and and November 9th, touch base with each of you individually. So as you think about things and want to give me some sense of what your interests or priorities are, that I'll collect that information from each of you so we have that kind of individual impact or input for we go ahead with the next meeting. So are you okay with the plan?
Mm-hmm.
We will then work on managing all of these items and at least getting some information about them. And we had already invited Mr. Brainerd to come, but we haven't yet invited someone from NCSL, but hopefully we can find someone there that can come along and give us some information about what other states are looking at.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Rosen.
Thank you. And I'm going to dig out my Pew Foundation information, too. They had some very good information about what other states are doing.
Okay. Good.
And drag that along.
Good. Well, I a very sincere thank you to all of you for your attention and attendance. I really appreciate that. And I think we've had another two good days of hearing about some important issues for us to consider. So thank you very much. And with that, we're adjourned.